Danke.
Thank you. So over the 10 years or so I've been in my career as a computer programmer, I've worked with a whole range of people, different backgrounds, different personalities and temperaments. Almost all of them have been men. That seems to be something particular to computer science, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. It's just the way that it seems to be in the industry. And the majority of them, and I probably have to include myself in this, do fit a particular stereotype. You may know this. There's a joke that goes about computer programmers. It says this: so how can you spot an extrovert computer programmer? They look at your shoes when they're talking to you. So, yes, but one person I worked with stands out for a couple of reasons that say something about, I think, about this passage in a way, in a roundabout way. There's a guy I've worked with who would always have something to say. He'd always have an opinion. He'd always have possibly an argument. Most of the time they were worth listening to, occasionally not. He would always have views that maybe divided people. He was, I guess you might call him like Marmite, you know, love him or hate him type thing. He would always bring out opinions in people. But he was well liked, and I'm not picking on him and saying he was nasty in any way. But there was some things he wouldn't budge on. He'd often come up with a line, something like, "This isn't something about personal preference. This is a fundamental technical reason we have to do this way," and try and end the argument there and then. We did actually joke that if he was left in a room on his own, he'd probably be able to start an argument. And I'm not sure if it ever happened, but I think the possibility is there. But his passion came from wanting to make our software, something as mundane as computer software, good for our customers, and also something that was, you know, as good as it could be to work on for the rest of us spending 8 hours a day or whatever working on his software. This is where his passion for this came from, and this is what made him behave in this way. So I think in some ways he actually shares the personality traits with Paul that we're looking at in who wrote this letter of Galatians. I'm not going to take the analogy too far. There's some stuff that came out of this guy's mouth that I wouldn't think Paul would ever say, so it's not a complete fit, but I think there was something there. I think from what when I looked into it, they actually probably came from a similar part of the world, so maybe there's something about that personality. But the difference is that with Paul has this passion for something more significant, something more long-lasting than a piece of software, not to do down my job or something like that, but it's not up there with what Paul. When Paul talks through Galatians, and we're going to go in a moment, Paul's passion is for the gospel. Paul's passion is for spreading the word of Jesus, preaching it to particularly the Gentiles. That was his thing. If you've read the book of Acts, you know about this passion. Here are the stories of Paul's missionary journeys. He went on multiple missionary trips. He faced really tough times. And that's not something you do for something you're just a bit, you know, murt about, you know. This is something he cared about. He was passionate for this. He was going around preaching to people who sometimes didn't want to hear what he had to say. You don't go through that if you don't care what you're talking about. But I think even if we were to just read just this bit of Galatians, there's something of this passion that comes across. And that's what we're going to look at tonight. If you haven't already got it open, I'd like to turn to Galatians chapter 2 that Alan read for us. As he said, it's on page 1168 of your pew Bibles. And a very short little quiz. I want to have a look at verse 5 and verse 14. See if anyone can spot there's a repeated phrase that's in both of those verses. So Galatians 2, verse 5 and verse 14. Can anyone shout out the phrase that's in both of those? Anyone brave enough? The truth of the gospel. Yes, exactly. Thank you. The truth of the gospel. Both times that's mentioned in these two stories that make up this the part of the passage we're looking at tonight. So it's not just merely the gospel that Paul cares about, but it's the truth of it. He wants to ensure that it isn't eroded or watered down, and so much of what he does in these passages is driven by that. It's about the true gospel. If this gospel wasn't true, its significance would be gone. It would just be a nice story. Because it's true, it has so much more importance. This actually links back to something that Terry talked about in the beginning of Galatians. If you look back at the beginning of beginning of chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. Galatians chapter 1, 6 and 7 says this: "I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the gospel of Christ." So Paul's desperate to share this gospel, to explain it, and to ensure that it isn't compromised. And that's what drives him in these passages. And it's his actions, and we see this passion come out, this passion he has for the gospel that he holds on to above all else. We see through his actions him living that out. So as Alan mentioned, this passage sort of ends at a strange place, and we'll go on to why that is, but it's kind of split into two halves. We have this, the first section, chapter 2, verses 1 down to 10, is basically an acceptance. It's talking about, agreement and acceptance. Next slide, thank you. So we read about Paul going up to Jerusalem, and he's setting before the apostles, going to talk to them about his preaching of the gospel. But what's quite interesting, he's not being summoned. It's not like they're trying to tell him off for preaching the wrong sort of thing or wanting him to go and explain. It's not that he necessarily feels the need to go and explain itself either. But he goes there because it's a revelation from God. God's behind this. God's behind him going up there and having this talk or these discussions. We can see that in verse 2. So Paul himself is saying, "I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas. I took Titus along too." Sorry, in verse 2. "I went up in response to a revelation and meeting privately with those esteemed as leaders." And he goes on to talk about how he wanted to make sure he wasn't running his race in vain. Now, I guess on sort of first reading of this, we could see that maybe, or think that maybe Paul was having doubts about his mission, about his work in amongst the Gentiles. But from what we know maybe about Paul, from all the other things he talks about, this is probably unlikely. Paul's absolutely convinced about the gospel of Jesus Christ. He talks about that throughout bits of chapter 1 and other places as well. And he's absolutely convinced about his need to preach it to the Gentiles. Instead, what's going on here a bit is that Paul's echoing back some of the words he's been criticised with, that people have held up against him. There was people out there, Jews, non-believers, a mix of people who are really attacking Paul, attacking what he was saying, attacking his message. And so he's not so much saying this about running his race in vain. He's not doing it to address his own doubts, but really to squash any accusations that his mission and work is invalid or not part of God's plan. That's key to him, that his work is not about him, it's about God's plan and what God wants done. And later on in verses 4 and 5, if you look further down, we learn a bit more about what's happening. Clearly, Paul's being attacked, like we said, for what he was sharing. There's people who flat out disagreed with it or wanted him to change it or stop talking. And it was this that they were attacking Paul on. Now, I'm going to kind of skirt around the issue of what really they're attacking for in this particular place. Not because I want to address it, because I want to leave that for the next part. And that's part of why this passage stops here. But it's around circumcision and who should be circumcised, who should not be circumcised, and what that meant for Christians and believers. It talks about that a bit in the verses. And this is the thing that he's being attacked by false believers for. He describes them himself as false believers. These are people who are not holding back in their anger maybe against Paul. These are people who are making trouble for Paul, stirring things up. But when Paul gets up to Jerusalem, he goes about things in quite a humble way. He meets with the apostles privately. He sets out to them his gospel. He talked before about how his gospel was from God and not from man. He was quite clear to say that he wasn't necessarily following other people. So there's some significance that they accept him. And they do in verse 9. James, Cephas, or Peter as we'd call him, and John, those esteemed as pillars, gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship when they recognized the grace given to me. They agreed we should go to the Gentiles and they should to the circumcised. I think in some ways it's easy to kind of miss the significance of this agreement, who's involved with it. You have these four men, James, Peter, John and Paul, who basically went on to write large chunks of the New Testament. So there's a real big significance in knowing that they agreed. It actually talks in the verses about how they didn't add anything to his message, they didn't take anything away. They agreed with it as it is. So it wasn't that they sat down and hashed a few things out and got him to change some stuff. He was preaching what they believed, they were preaching what he believed. This agreement, this significance. If they differed in what they were preaching, it would have been a problem. The gospel would have been divided. I don't know what you're like with conflicts or disagreements. I'm not one for this. I'm one to sort of sit there and say nothing and probably drive my wife crazy when she wants to point out some things I'm doing wrong. But there was quite a good example this week. I don't know if any of you saw this on the BBC website. It was one of the sort of top stories on there, maybe on the actual news as well and certain other places. And it involved a disagreement over a child's party. Has anyone seen this? Does anyone know where this story yet? So for those of you who don't know, this is a rough outline of what happened. A child was invited to his friend's party, and the parents initially said that he could go. And it got to the day, and due to some scheduling or something like that, he had a chance that he could see his grandparents, and he wasn't going to be able to see them, I think, for a little while. And they gave him the choice. They said, do you want to go to this party, or do you want to go and meet with your grandparents? He chose to go with his grandparents. And the parents at that time, this is one of the bits that's maybe a bit of he said, she said, the parents weren't able to contact the people whose party he was going to say they couldn't come. They didn't have the details, and so they didn't tell them about it, but they didn't think much of it. Until a week or so later, they actually got a letter through the post, opened it up, and inside was an official invoice for £15, which is basically the per-child cost of the party that the child wasn't able to go to. And I don't know how it got from that point to on the BBC News website. I don't know who submitted a story or how they got hold of it or whatever went on there. But, it all came out. You can see interviews with the dad and the child who missed the party, sort of explaining their side of things. The names of the people on the other side are mentioned. And, it's, I guess, in some ways turned into a bit of an event, really. Somehow they got hold of the Facebook discussion between the two mothers who tried to sort things out, and that didn't end so well. And, I don't know what side you might come down on. If you want to look into it, decide who you think's got the bigger grievance, the people who invited the child or the people who didn't turn out to the party. I'll let you decide that for yourself. But I think it's clear that things maybe weren't handled in the best way. Things got a bit out of hand. If a disagreement over a child's birthday party ends up on the BBC News website, it's got a bit wrong. And I'm guessing it's going to be quite awkward at those school gates the next time the parents meet. I assume that the children were friends. I don't know what's happened to that afterwards. And I'm guessing most people at the school know who everyone is involved. So disagreements can go wrong. That's the point. And what we see here in the second half of this chapter is Paul trying to have a disagreement, or Paul having a disagreement, actually, is a better way of describing it, and how that turns out. But he was treading a tough line. He was disagreeing with Peter. Peter, one of the three members of the early church, as we talked about before, significant parts of the Bible. So it's very strange. We get this kind of juddering change in the passage about halfway through. We've got this nice bit of agreement. They're talking about right hand of friendships. They're talking about how they agree on what they're talking on. And then next thing, Paul straight in there, verse 11. When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face. No background, no run up, straight in, you know. I opposed him to his face. He wasn't shying away from this. It's quite jarring. And maybe on the face of it, it's a small difference of opinion, this kind of thing around circumcision and what that meant. And this isn't necessarily even just around the idea of circumcision. It's about how Peter related to people who believe one side of the argument and dealt with people who saw a different side. So it's not even necessarily an outright argument, as we see in a minute. Peter was siding with one group over another. But again, the thing to notice about this is the two people who are involved. Peter, as we commonly know him, referred to here as Cephas. And Paul, I guess, if maybe you could describe him as two of the heavyweights of the early Christian church. If you were to go back and look in the book of Acts, the first half is a whole lot of stories that involve Peter quite often. And the second half is a whole lot of stories that involve Paul. Peter was one of the 12 disciples, but also part of an inner group of three who had maybe a more significant relationship with Jesus. He spent a bit more time with them, and they were part of events that some of the other disciples didn't share. And I guess as a result, he became one of the leaders of the early church in Jerusalem. And then you've got Paul who wrote all these letters, Galatians, Ephesians, and so on, that we see in the Bible. He is considered an apostle like them, even though he wasn't one of the disciples. And so whilst it's not really about putting people up on a pedestal, and in fact, in these very verses, Paul talks about that. It's one of the many other things he's packed into these verses, this warning about holding people up like that. But their actions and their thoughts and the way they behave carry weight. Maybe if this happened now, maybe if this is going on in the world we have now with the internet, 24-hour news, it'd be on the front page of the Church Times or something. There'd be articles online springing up about this disagreement, Paul going to Peter and saying this to his face and having a go at him. There'd be people debating which side, who is right, who is wrong. Should he have done it that way? Should he have handled it a different way? Maybe people weighing in on about their personalities and whether they are the right to do what they did. But what's significant, isn't that Peter's changed? He's not suddenly changed from these verses before. Before he's agreeing with Paul, he's stretching out the right hand of friendship and that. He's not suddenly made a U-turn in what he's thinking, really. He's not changed his opinion of Paul's message. What he's doing and what Paul calls him out for, in a way, is that he's acting in a way that's hypocritical. If you look at verses 12 and 13, Galatians 2, 12 and 13. For before certain men came from James, he used to eat, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. The other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy, so that by their hypocrisy, even Barnabas was led astray. So in a way, maybe we could think about it that Peter's bowing to peer pressure and going along with the crowd, this crowd that's come to visit him. Maybe he's afraid of what some of them might think. But before we jump on Peter and criticise him, I wonder how many of us have fallen in the same trap. I think it's quite easy to believe things in our head, to think about them on a Sunday, but not be able to follow through with them when the going gets tough. When people oppose us, when people argue back against them, when people dismiss those views. Often the easier thing to do is go along with the crowd, as we saw happening here, because we don't want to make a fuss, maybe. Or because standing up and being counted might have a cost. But Paul has no time for this. We can see how he deals with this hypocrisy. He opposes Peter to his face, he brings it out, he lays out his reasonings. Unlike how before with the apostles where things were done in private, this time he does it in public. And he's not mincing his words. Verse 14, you're a Jew, yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? So whilst we might not any longer have debates around circumcision and the particular things they're talking about here, I think it's an interesting challenge for us. When we disagree with people, are we able to discern the things that are core to the whole truth of the gospel and which things are on periphery? Paul wasn't doing this because he wanted to score points off Peter or because it was a minor thing. This was a thing that was core to the gospel. And that's why he approached it in this way. That's why he wouldn't let it go. Sometimes there are things we can agree to disagree on. But other times there are things like this that we have to make a stand on. I guess the hope is if we find ourselves in a situation where we're challenging someone, we can ask God for the wisdom, the guidance and the discernment to act in a way similar to Peter, to Paul, sorry. So I think in the space of not many verses, Paul's given us a lot to think about. And like I said, there's loads of other stuff in his passage, but I guess this is the point of his letters. He wanted to make sure the Galatians had as much as possible to to go on. He packs so much in. But I think underlying these two things, this agreement, this disagreement, this idea around opposing Peter and standing up to him, I think is all underlined by Paul's belief right back to the beginning, the truth of the gospel, these two things, these verses that are repeated in 5 and 14. The truth of the gospel. Paul was passionate about that. He was passionate about sharing it with others. He was passionate about making sure it was, the truth of it was kept. He was passionate about making sure it wasn't watered down or compromised, even if that meant disagreeing with someone like Peter. So I guess the question for us is, do we share this passion for the gospel that Paul has? Does it come through in our words and actions as it did with Paul? Can people look at situations in our life and see the passion for the gospel coming out? Is it something that pervades our entire life? My prayer is that we will be able to develop this Paul-like passion for the gospel. Amen.